Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
What if the golf ball you're playing isn't the number one ball for you? Meet the all-new TP5 and TP5X from TaylorMade. Whether you prefer the softest five-layer tour ball in the TP5 or the fastest, that's now a half a club longer in TP5X, you'll be playing a golf ball that performs like it was built just for you. Available in white, yellow, and picks, you can personalize it with my symbol. No matter which you choose, every TP5, TP5X is designed to help your game. Head to TaylorMadeGolf.com today to find the number one ball for you.
For us, golf is simple. It's a chance to get out and have some fun with our friends. But inevitably, little things have a way of ruining it. The group ahead is taking forever, you can't find the fairway with a map, and the bev cart is nowhere to be found. And the best way to make a bad day better is Fireball Whiskey. You get their nips, the little shooters. They are great. Makes bad day way, way, way better. Make sure to grab the new Fireball Birdie Shot Club. It's literally a golf club filled with Fireball nips. Put it in your bag. It'll fit right in that side pocket. Drink Fireball nips and have a great time on the golf course.
Reveille, reveille, reveille. Welcome back to another edition of Zero Block 30. Today, we have four rounds of the magazine. Round number one, the Unabomber is dead. Old Ted Kaczynski is deader than a doornail after spending 20 years in one of the worst places on earth. Round number two, there's a shit ton of documents that I'm sure that you've seen for that's two. I told you last time that I was going to cuss already one right
it
there.
It takes some discipline. You're going to have to train your head.
It takes some insane discipline. So President Trump, obviously you know about the classified documents and what's going on there. There was also an audio recording of him knowingly saying that he was going to show classified information to other people. And now that the real indictments have come down, they look pretty bad. All of the different information about the indictments look awful, and they said that there's even more stuff that they haven't released yet.
But don't worry. This round is just about the documents in his bathroom. I was just tickled by it because I can relate to it.
Yeah, it's just going
to be quick. Yeah, it's just quick, easy. Documents in the bathroom. I loved it. I enjoyed it.
No free podcast ads, but if you want to get into the weeds, there was the guy that we had on who did the going through Hillary Clinton's email. He was on Lawfare podcast, which goes into national security issues, and he broke it down, and it was awesome. Like, it was really, really informative. So that was weird, plugging another podcast on my own. But anyway, finally, we're going to talk about there's a couple that passed out at the king's coronation. That's the king of the United Kingdom, by the way. That's that king that we're talking about. Oh, King Charles.
I think this is like birthday or something like that. Some crazy thing. But anyway, it was just
a quick round. You just had your coronation less than a month ago, you shouldn't get a birthday.
No, agreed. I agree.
Agreed. It's too much.
If you want to be a cool king who's loved, be like, guess what? All troops have the weekend off this weekend. Bye, everybody.
Exactly right. Whatever. Exactly right. And if you want to do that, just – these kids, it's basically like the king has to be a kid that's born in December. Like, you want to have a big birthday party for them, but they don't deserve it. Like, you don't deserve Christmas and your birthday in the same month.
Right, right. So get out of here with that.
Neither does the king. I lost my train of thought there.
Interview is the last round. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Interview is the last round. And this one was – I know that when a really good interview happens whenever I am talking to – these folks after it's over. And Tom Hanton was one of those interviews because he was a prisoner of war for 275 days at the Hanoi Hilton. We've talked to Charlie Plum, and as you know, John McCain was there as well. He talked about some of those experiences and broke down really what it was like for him being shot down, being able to see different people with AK-47s and the muzzle flashes while he was in a parachute in the middle of the sky looking for a place that he could land. I can't imagine that level of terror. He talks about hiding in the bamboo, what happened whenever he was caught, the injuries that he sustained. It's really incredible, his life story. And then not only that, but it's another example of what Vietnam prisoners of war, by and large, have come to show and demonstrate in society. How they are so balanced and calm and collected is... I wouldn't be like that. Like, I look at myself and how much I talk about my experiences. They're so humble. And I was trying to think why when I was thinking about this interview all weekend long. And I think it's maybe because they have experienced the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. So no matter what happens from there forward, it's not going to be as bad as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so you have that perspective, and that's kind of what we see, and it's what you see at Tom, just very calm and humble. You're going to love this interview. But let's get going with the actual show today, round one.
Quality sleep optimizes recovery, helping professional and everyday athletes perform their best. Only the Sleep Number Smart Bed is proven to improve the quality of sleep and provides valuable insights that can be used to support overall wellness. Talent on a college team allows the best players to outperform their opponents, but in the NFL, everyone is talented. Players entering the draft need every competitive edge they can get, starting with quality sleep. Training will only get more intense as players transition to the pros, so to optimize recovery, they can rely on Sleep Number for consistent, high-quality sleep. Experience game-changing sleep with a Sleep Number smart bed only at a Sleep Number store.
What do we got, Kate?
Ding dong, the Unabomber is dead, everyone. Ted Kaczynski.
Indeed. Hand up, didn't know he was still alive.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, me either. Thought it was death penalty.
He was laying low. He was laying low. Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber, died by suicide in prison over the weekend at age 81 after dealing with late-stage cancer. He was known for a 17-year bombing campaign that killed 3 people and injured 23 others, leaving many of them permanently maimed. However he left this world, there was zero chance he was going to do it as a free man anyway, since he was sentenced to 4 life sentences plus 30 years for the campaign of terror that set the entire country on edge for decades, really.
I didn't know that either, that it went on for 17 years.
17 mm-hmm. years. He was a Harvard-educated mathematician. Incredibly smart man. But ended up living as a recluse in a dingy cabin in the boonies of Montana. And there are some fascinating interviews with some of his neighbors who were like, he was a total dick, he was a weirdo, he was this and that. There's fascinating interviews of people who knew him at Harvard, where he had enrolled himself, like college students enroll in studies for like cash and extra credits and blah, blah, blah. He was enrolled in like psychological mind studies where they would fuck with people, like fuck with the students. And like he would get talked down to and treated meanly as part of the studies.
Wait, not the Harvard experiments, right?
Not the Harvard experiments, but like he was part of experiments too. Do some Googling and looking around if you're looking for something to do. It's kind of fascinating, his story. I don't think that's why he did the things he did. I think he was just a bad dude. But anyway, pretty interesting. He targeted, by the way, this 17-year spree completely changed the way that we mailed packages and boarded airplanes and all kinds of stuff. Like, it caused like a security revolution, much like 9/11 did. After 9/11, we had to relook at everything over again. His targets included academics and the airlines, the owner of a computer rental store, an ad exec, and a timber industry lobbyist. In 1993, a California geneticist and a Yale University computer expert were maimed by bombs within the span of 2 days. Two years later, he reached out to the New York Times and the Washington Post saying, publish my manifesto, or more bad stuff is going to happen. And after a big back and forth with the editors, they published his manifesto, 35,000 words. And a lot of people were
It just goes to show, if you have a manifesto, you're crazy. Like, you can't write a manifesto and be normal.
And people were very against, like, how could you publish this? How could you do, like, share this crazy killer's words? Well, it turns out his brother, Ted Kaczynski's brother, David, and David's wife, Linda, they read the manifesto and they were like, because Ted and his brother, they pretty much just kept in contact via letter writing. And Ted Kaczynski's brother was like, I recognize the phrasing syntax and the syntax of this manifesto. Oh my God, I think it's my brother. So his own brother tipped off the FBI, who had been searching for the Unabomber. It was one of the costliest manhunts ever. It cost taxpayers $50 million.
Wow.
Over those 17 years to catch him. And it ended up being his brother reading the manifesto in the newspaper and being like, holy shit, that's my brother. In 1996, authorities found him in a small plywood and tar paper cabin outside Lincoln, Montana, that was filled with journals, a coded diary, explosives, ingredients, and 2 completed bombs. So he was definitely going to keep on doing
it. That's what they call in the biz, red-handed.
Yeah. They really did. So pretty
kind of crazy. I just remember, you know, being sixth grade, I knew the broad strokes of Ted Kaczynski. I didn't know all this other stuff. And then it came to light again when I remember watching Good Will Hunting for the first time, and he's like talking about a guy. He's like, yeah, a guy went to University of Michigan, then he went to go teach at Cal Berkeley, and then he went to Montana, blew the competition away. And he's like, who are you talking about? Ted Kaczynski.
It's yeah.
Like, that's a good reference in pop culture. Got to give him Matt and Ben that credit. But I didn't know he was still alive. I didn't know he did this for over the 17 years, and it's crazy it took him that long to find him. But I guess when you're living in the mountains.
And I think we all thought that he got the death penalty. Actually, this is great because I've told you guys in the youth, the group chat, how much I like looking at like Supermax prisons and shit like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's really interesting. Ted Kaczynski was in the worst prison, some say, in the entire world.
Where?
So when you say like the death penalty is bad, this sentence that he got is exponentially worse than death. I would choose the most painful death in the world to avoid what he had to do. So there's a place called ADX Florence, and ADX Florence is the biggest. There's only one Supermax like to this level in the United States. They have razor wire not only like 25, 30 feet high. They have razor wire all the way over the top of the installation too. So no helicopters can land to get some people that are in there like El Chapo.
Ooh.
It's completely covered. All of the cells are in the ground. They're lowered in the ground, and there's one window that's 4 inches thick and 4 feet long. The only thing they could see is the sky. For the rest of their lives, until they're transferred out, which most don't, for the rest of their lives, all they see is the sky at the most. Their cells, 9x7. The only thing that's in there is a concrete bed, a concrete stool, and a thin mattress that's no bigger than 1.5 inches thick with cotton on the inside. They get half of a pillow, like hand-sized pillow, and then one bed sheet that's like 3x5, so it's not long enough for you to choke yourself and kill yourself. Not only that, they get no human interaction except for 1 hour a day. They get to go out to the rec time, and then they move into a 12x10 area. Again, fully concrete. The only thing that you could see is the sky. If they touch a person, like if they're putting in their tray, if they touch you, you can get shot and killed. And they all know it. Like, if you step off of a line whenever you're going, they could kill you. Like, it's almost instantaneous death for whatever they're doing, unless you indicate that that's what you want. If you indicate that that's what you want, you're not going to get it. The wardens that have left there had said that this is hell on earth, that people are in there that were in Guantanamo Bay. And they write the human rights places and be like, this is so much worse than whatever happened in Guantanamo Bay. So when we talk about they got off light for the death penalty, 23 and a half hours of day isolation for 20 years in the worst prison in the world.
Yeah, I think that's so much worse than
so
the death
much
penalty.
Worse. The other people, notable people that are in there is the Boston bomber is in there. El Chapo is in there. Timothy McVeigh spent a little while, and his Nichols was the co-conspirator with Timothy McVeigh. He's in there as well. The ice cream serial killer, the Golden Gate, almost all people that are incredibly, incredibly dangerous or those that have killed several people in prison will go there.
Yeah, and not to get into moral discussion about death penalty versus not death penalty, but I absolutely think, as I said, that is so much worse to live there.
Dog, 20 years with 23 and a half hour days?
Forget it. You lose your mind. But
rightfully so. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
there's one interview if you guys want to look into it. It's called ADX Florence, and there was a mobster that was in there for, I think, 12 years. And at the end, he won an appeal, so he was released. And it's the longest interview that somebody's done because typically when you go in ADX, the only way you're coming out is in a body bag. But he actually got released, and he talked about it, and it is chilling, to say the least.
Yeesh.
Anyways, let's move on.
Let's move on to round number two.
Here's the truth.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequilacation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
Yeah, let's
come yeah, on, let's talk about that. Yeah.
These photos came out over the and like
I'm so glad I finally had an opportunity to talk about all those and it fit in. I've been want to for a while.
I didn't know. Yeah, you I could tell. An expert. I didn't know you were a
big prison geek there.
I know. This just I'm putting sometimes I just put on my blinders. I'm like I'm like worn out on politics. I don't care. This just delighted me. Seeing these boxes in the bathroom, I just really, whatever. Anyway.
It's like Arrested Development, like, right? Yeah.
It feels like a...
It's the banana stand.
It doesn't feel real, I guess. And so that's why it just seems so comical and so silly. Classified documents are normally kept in what is called a SCIF, a.k.a. a sensitive compartmented information facility. But in this particular case, they were kept in a skiff, a.k.a. a stinky commode in Florida, folks.
Okay. That's exactly right, Kate.
Anyways, when Trump left the White House, his staff moved dozens and dozens and dozens of boxes from D.C. down to Mar-a-Lago, his famous residence slash, it's like a club you can be a member of that has all kinds of different events and all this stuff.
Heard that Trump did a Diddy move.
Did a little Diddy move. It wasn't his fault. The movers come in so quick there. They just wrap everything up and there's nothing you could do. But all these boxes got moved down to his primary post-presidential residence, Mar-a-Lago, and his house down in Florida. And where do you put all this stuff? And you know the type, the white, thick cardboard boxes.
The lawyer's boxes.
They're like lawyer's boxes.
Documents boxes, yeah. For files and such.
Boxes. So there's this photo of them, like the... U.S. government documents, national security secrets about nuclear weapons and foreign militaries, all this stuff that he was not allowed to remove from government custody that got brought down there. It's sitting on the stage of it stacked all over the place. The boxes got moved around. So if they were having an event in this area of the house, they would just shuffle them over to another area of the house. Move those.
Like, so annoying.
Like showing the house.
Yeah,
so
like
annoying.
Stacked high in a storage room. Carted to Trump's private chambers, crammed into a bathroom next to a shower stall. And it's these document boxes right next to a toilet with a big chandelier over top of them. He's got to get into my parents. You got to get a shredder, buddy. You got to get a shredder. You gotta.
Well,
my mom's
I think a couple things when you look at this story. You know, number one, like he's brash. He could have declassified a lot of these documents from what I understand. And he just didn't.
Doesn't have the authority in a lot
not
of
anymore.
Ways.
No, not anymore.
No, but even
when he was
as
president?
The president. Nope. There's certain things as long if it has human intelligence and if it has nuclear secrets, there has to be a triumvirate of people that say it. Like there is certain information that the president has the ability to declassify. Human intelligence and nuclear secrets are not one.
Okay, I was reading something in, I think it was the Washington Post maybe, that said he could have done that or he could have filed for a waiver so that he could have possession of them in a different area.
Yes, and it has to be approved, exactly.
Okay, so there's things he could have done to have this done. But I think more importantly, anytime we see the inside of anything that is owned by Trump, you just see how terrible of a decorator he is. His taste is disgusting. It's gaudy. Yeah. It's dated. It's just horrible.
And he went into the world's biggest Ross and picked out everything.
Yeah.
Well, it's like a heightened level of, remember in the 90s, like everybody's moms tried to make their kitchen look like a Tuscan Italian villa.
Yes.
It's like that, that aesthetic.
By the way,
like,
the downstairs bathroom at my new house looks exactly like that. Looks like an Olive Garden.
And now there's been such a backlash. Everyone's doing just beige living, plain beige, nothing, because I feel like there's such a
monochromatic.
But it all came up in 2021. This guy, Walt Nauta, I'm probably saying that wrong, Nauta, he was an aide to Trump, and he like opens up one of the doors and one of the boxes has tipped over and all these documents are just spilled out. And I guess he takes a picture of it. These aren't the exact, I don't know what the exact, but he sends it to another Trump aide, probably being like, oh my God. Like, dude,
it's
like,
just funny looking. It's just funny looking to see all those boxes all over different parts of his house.
That's
a ridiculous story. Like, on its face, it's such a very like Trumpian thing to do. Like, it's such a Trump story. And it's funny because you have all these – but then when you think about the documents that are inside those folders and some of what, like, we've read about them, and it's, like, legit national security secrets that show not only our weaknesses and it's our own government's open about our weaknesses, but the weaknesses of our allies, that's a pretty significant one.
But right? I also like, though, the reverse psychology of nobody's going to look in here. You wouldn't True. Think I
would look in my bathroom.
I would go to the bathroom in there. Say I'm drunk at a party at Mar-a-Lago and I make my way to that bathroom somehow and I'm sitting on the toilet. I'm going to be looking at these boxes cracking up. But
imagine you go in there and you're trying to, you know, do a number two and you're True. Looking for an old Sports Illustrated and instead you find, you know, nuclear classified secrets to read instead.
Like that's basically treat. What Trump's house was. It was like the dentist's office with nothing but High Life magazines strung about.
Anyway, interesting. He's facing 37 counts related to sensitive documents in his bathroom. And I just ain't
you know
that
what
America.
I found interesting that I read?
You and me. Ain't that America documents?
He reached out. I don't know if he reached out, but he made mention of, hey, let's whoever like handled Hillary's whole thing with her emails that were deleted. He's like, we need to follow that game plan because she got off from doing all that. So whatever
they
she
all,
did,
she was sending.
But they did like they
she
went
was sending
through
classified
it.
Shit over like a Gmail account. Like they all, it's these olds. I'm telling you, it's if Biden's got some in his garage. It's the olds. They're just we gotta keep everybody check in on your olds today. Make sure they're not
look in their bathrooms. They might have national security.
Right, go look in their bathrooms, please. Anyway,
I will say though, that's way better toilet information than TikTok, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Like, you walk out of that bad boy, you know some shit.
You
legit.
Probably do.
Let me ask you this.
Damn it. Oh.
Sorry, that was two. That was back to back.
Yeah.
Damn it doesn't count, right? Not anymore.
It depends on how strict you want to be. But really quickly. Yeah,
so, no, I don't want to be. I want PG-13.
Damn it. Damn it got replaced by cunt, I think.
Whoa.
Is a bad word.
Yeah, hard
C-bomb. Whoa, this isn't Britain. Relax.
I actually don't think that counts as a curse word, though. Right?
No.
It's a vulgar word.
They say
it's
it in Australia like a friendly thing. I'm taking it. I'm taking it back.
Not in this country. Really quickly, though, what do you prefer when you're in doing your business? A hard copy of something or looking at your phone?
Oh, phone in a million. Like because you can't wipe off a book. Like if you,
you know what I miss,
on.
Though? I miss those days. We used to have an enormous Far Side cartoon book. And also Dilbert, I used to hand up. I used to read a lot of Dilbert before Scott Adams went whack.
Big Dilbert head.
But we had two big cartoon books, and that was it. And so for 16 years, it was me reading these same comics and these same, like, whatever. Anyway, I miss those days. I miss flipping through, looking for a
My favorite all-time book for the toilet, Where's Waldo? I just look for that
good one too.
Over and over again.
Yeah, I'm going to bring that back. I'm going to bring that back, I think. The
Please
toilet
do.
Books.
Kate walks into the office and she's got a stack of
She's got a stack of books like Bill Gates Waldo. Going for the weekend. She's
exactly
got a canvas
right.
bag of books.
My big joke at Eagles tailgates before I walk into the porta potty, I go in and then I poke my head back out and I go, does anybody have a New York Times? And then I go back in.
People love it.
People
they go bananas.
Anybody have a Philly Inquirer I can borrow for a second?
Start clapping.
I'll be
up
quick.
There, doing the wave for Kate. It's awesome. Yeah. The whole thing. All right, what do we got for round number three?
With golf season in full swing, Chevy wants to help you make the most of every drive, and the all-electric Blazer EV's bold design and dynamic performance make it the perfect electric vehicle to get you to the course in style and comfort. Chevrolet, together let's drive.
Just a quick one. Like we just all love when this happens because it happens to every unit at some point in the heat. Don't lock your knees when you're standing in formation. You're going to pass out. Every summer videos go viral all around the globe. It's one thing that connects all troops from North Korea down to Brazil, wherever. Several British soldiers fainted on Saturday while rehearsing for King Charles's upcoming birthday parade. And you're right. Enough with the parades for this guy. We're all burned out on it right now.
Been waiting so many years for this to all come to fruition, for him to become king. So he's like, it's almost like he's being let loose in the candy store, right? So he's just going nuts because he doesn't know
how to handle
himself
as king. Looking at his swollen hands, he's not going to be around much longer. Let's be real.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I want to be a mighty king, so enemies beware. How do you not have that at your coronation? If I was going to be king, that's what I would do. Or William, I guess, could play that song more than... Mm-hmm. Simba.
Well, it was 86 degrees over in the UK, which usually just don't happen. It doesn't get hot like that. During, and they wear these, you think some of our uniforms are bad. They wear the thickest woolen, long sleeve, bright red, black pants, the giant fur hats on an 86 degree day. Three different guardsmen keeled over under the blazing sun at the House Guards, parade practice. The video shows a trombonist go down, and then two others go down, and then. But the best part is,
I want one of the British soldiers to have a slide whistle.
But in this particular case, it went mega viral because everyone was cracking up that he goes down, and everyone else just keeps trumpeting right over his completely limp body. Nobody missed a beat. Mm-hmm. They just keep doing like that's cold blooded. But anyway, I just
know what they call that, Kate.
What?
Mission accomplishment, troop welfare.
That's right. Mission accomplishment first. But anyway, don't lock your knees is the moral of that story as we head into summertime.
Yep. All right. Well, let's move into the interview with Tom Hanton, who once again is a former backseater in a F-14. I think that's it. I always mess up planes. I'm the worst at planes. The absolute worst at it. Retired as a lieutenant colonel. Doing amazing things still, and here he is.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
All right, let's move on to some save rounds and alibis. Catherine, we'll start with you.
Ooh, I've just almost blurted out the first thing that came to my mind, which is, fellas, I pooped twice today.
Oh, yeah, all right. Hey, that's great, though. That's an improvement.
Huge news for me. I've been struggle bussing. Yeah. People don't realize what these hormones do to you. Cons, I know you're experiencing it firsthand, but there's a lot more to it than you think.
Now, let me ask you a question here, Kate. What's that relief like? Because you know me, I've never probably been constipated in my entire life, so I don't know what that stressor's like. What's the relief there?
You ever put on a coat you haven't worn in a while and you find $50 in the pocket and you're pumped for like several hours afterwards? That's what it feels like for some reason. I take a poop now.
An unexpected win.
And I'm like, this is going to be a good morning. I feel mentally pumped. When it happens.
It's like a weight's lifted off
and
of you.
I'm halfway. Halfway through, and I've only bought one pair of maternity pants from Target late one night in desperation. Not wearing maternity pants.
What happened to the pants you wore the first go round?
I got rid of them all because I never thought I would be pregnant again.
Didn't think there was going to be a second go.
Wow, okay.
I got rid of everything, Cons. I said this was a real treat. Never going to do it again.
Okay. Didn't know that.
Anyway, so that's that. But check this out, just video purposes.
Okay.
Hold on. Ready?
So. Wink. Oh, wow. Katie, baby belly.
It's big as hell. It's not poop. Yeah. But I pooped twice this morning. But anyway, just cracking me up wearing these pants. I feel like Tweedledee and Tweedledum. The little pants are scrunched down at the bottom. I have no ass. It's like completely flat. And then this huge whatever. Boy, I guess that's it for me.
We're doing Katie self-esteem here in Safe Rounds. I love it.
Everyone else tell me why I'm gross.
No, you're doing fantastic.
I look bad today, too.
Okay. You look great. I mean, how many months pregnant are you now? Like 4.5, 5?
People keep asking me. I've no idea. I don't do numbers. I don't do numbers.
Oh, keep it going, Kate. Like, just wait and be like, oh, baby time.
Mom almost said 20
coming out
weeks.
Today.
20 weeks-ish, which I don't know how many months coming. That is. I don't know.
20 weeks 20 is like weeks. 5 months?
Yeah, 4.5 months. I was right. Yeah, 5 months, right.
It's crazy because the math doesn't check out. Like, your whole life you're told, like, how long are women pregnant for? 9 months. No, not really, because you go to 40 weeks. That's basically 10 months.
It's like 10, People need to start thinking. Yeah. Oh, last note.
Why take a month off? Give it to yourself. Round up.
Give it to yourself. I've been losing weight at each of my appointments. They're like, oh, you lost a pound or two. You lost a pound or two. And I'm like, well, look at you. Whoa, look at me go. Wow. And then finally I went to the hospital and they're like, you gained 13 pounds. So I'm about, I just have a feeling in my bones. I'm going to be Big Kate this season. I'm going
to
be.
No, you're allowed to. Give yourself some credit.
I'm going
to. Yeah, just dive in, become best friends with both Ben and Jerry.
I'm going to. Anyways, I guess that's it for me. I just wanted everyone to be very intimately up to date on what's going on with my intestines and my body.
That's exactly what Save Rounds is for, Kate. I'm glad you did it. Cons, while Kate was talking, I thought of one thing because she said tight pants was. Mm. Now, I think everybody's this way. Guy, girl, doesn't matter who it is. Going up a size in pants hurts. Like if you're from 34 and you go to 36, it hurts. If you're 36, 38, 30 to 32, not bad. But once you go from 34 to 36, it's different. So hold on to 34 as much as I can when I got out of the Marines. But if you hold on too long, correct me if I'm wrong here, Cons, if you have pants that are too tight, you'll get yourself an ingrown pube, folks. You got to be careful.
Yep, amen. I know Cons would agree. Cons
is that a problem
huge...
for you?
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever had that
guy.
Problem.
Yeah,
but I was thinking...
You got to pull them tweezers out and pull that thing out. It's like a fucking rope spool. It just keeps coming and coming and coming.
Yeah, yeah. I think
all right,
was a,
Cons, anyways. What about you?
A,
what do you got?
A John Mellencamp line. Hold on to size 34 pants as long as I can, right?
I think. Don't let go.
But no, same thing, though, dude. I held on to 34s. I was 34 for the vast majority of my adulthood. And then, like, I'm not quite 36. Like, I'm 35 in some pants.
Yeah.
But still, it's... Knowing that you can't get 34s anymore, just not happening for you. It's like, all right, I guess I'm just past that part in my life. That's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
Anyway, I put out something so scientific last night, speaking of getting older.
You know I love science.
I don't know what made me think of this. We're sitting there watching TV, and I look over to Alex. I go, how long do you have to know someone for you to say, I've known that person a long time?
I think there's phases in life that are different. So, like high school, I think anything longer than a year and a half, you know them. I actually think that translates to the military, too. If you've been around somebody for a year in the military and they've been in, like, your unit or your platoon, you feel like you've known them your whole fucking life, right?
Mm. Yeah. No, Kate,
but I would say normal life, how long do you have to know somebody if you know them a long time? I would say probably... 5 to 8 years for a long time?
I think that I don't know. It's all relative to your age, too. But yeah, I'm with Kate. I think you have to know someone 10 plus years for you to say, I've known that person a long time.
So, Cons, you wouldn't say you've known me for a long time?
No. And here's what I would
say. You've known each other for almost 10 years.
Here's how I would classify you. I was hoping somebody would come to this conclusion, and former producer Kyle came to this conclusion, and I think he nailed it. If you've known someone for a year or less, I know that person. 2 to 4 years, known that person for a bit. 5 to 9 years, what we've known you for a while. 10 plus, I've known that person a long time.
So let me get this straight, Cons. You truly believe that you don't know your wife for a long time?
No, not yet.
That's
not yet.
Insane. Yeah. That is absolutely insane.
If I'm talking to you about my poop, then I feel like I've known you a long time. I feel like it's been 10 years.
I mean, by the letter of the law.
That how well you know somebody is different from how long. I could see that differentiation too.
Yes, yes.
They came out like little rabbit turds today.
Yeah, by the way, I watched a couple vids this weekend of rabbits getting birth. That shit will blow your... There's like 50 of them in those things just fucking popping out. What, Kate?
Why? Mm-hmm. Why is that your algorithm?
Because I've been watching a lot of garden talk.
I've been
watching a lot of garden stuff because I want to do a terrarium, like a self-sustaining ecosystem. I think I've talked about that. I've watched so many videos. I'm doing it. When I move to Chicago, because I don't want my ecosystem to get fucked up, obviously, on the move. There's a guy that I saw. He has this ecosystem. This thing hasn't been unsealed in 35 years, and there's still, like, little beetles going around, little worms going around. Like,
really?
There's things that are growing. It's a self-sustained ecosystem. Like, it has
it's
humidity
like Biodome,
on the inside.
The movie.
That, yes, that's where all the water comes from. It's self-sustaining, and it blows my mind how they do it.
That's pretty cool. But, yeah, I guess, chaps, maybe it's a little different with my wife, but I think by the letter of law, I haven't known her in a long time. I've only known her for a while.
Knowing really well and knowing a long time are different.
Very different. But that's my scientific conclusion. And I also know Nick agrees as well. It's 10 plus years to know somebody a long time.
Okay. And I also think that depends on how old you are. At 40, I think it's that long. At 15, not so
If you, much. If we went through puberty together through those years, then you know me. Damn.
Oh, yeah.
If, you're saying you
if we're
stick
stinking
with me,
and spraying our bodies with Axe body spray.
Right. And you stuck with me through that, then yeah. Shout out Martha, Jacqueline, and Mandy.
Or through your mullet face.
Me at my worst. Yeah, that, them too. They were there for that. Anyways.
Yeah. Mine is, I am sick and tired of this house buying process, and house selling, I think, is worse than house buying.
You think
because
so?
You have to, oh.
I haven't given it any thought, so let me hear. I really haven't given it a thought.
You sold your house in Texas when you weren't there.
That's true. I was like so hands off. I was like, I let my realtor and my property manager take
there.
Care of it. Yeah.
So if you're selling while you're still in the house, everything has to be spotless. At all times.
Yeah.
And nobody lives that way. And like realtors and people that are going to buy a house, I don't give a fuck when I'm going to buy a house. But they're like, oh, you got shampoo? Who uses shampoo? These people are fucking dirty. They got shampoo. Got to put the trash can in the garage because people don't know we have fucking trash cans. We got to make sure that the pillows are exactly right. We have to make sure that there's absolutely nothing on the countertops. No toasters, no coffee. We don't have toast and coffee in this house. We don't do it.
I'll say this, though. I don't know how you guys think. I'm going through the house searching and buying process. If you gave me the same house, one had a bunch of clutter and one was like really well decorated and pristine, but it was the exact same house, I'd say the one that's clean, devoid of clutter, is the better house.
Sure. I agree with the cleanliness. The cleanliness has got to be top notch.
Mm-hmm.
But we can organize our shampoo, right? Like, you could put your shampoo. Nobody's going to come in and be like, these fuckers have shampoo, these pieces
of but
shit.
It's just that much more clutter. I'm telling you, I remember we looked at one house.
No, I know.
And there was just stuff.
We need to just get over it as a society.
Well, maybe. What were you going to say, Kate? The inspector went through the house that I bought and took a bunch of photos. And I was given that report. And it made me feel better because I'm moving into a house of the family has two boys. And I'm going to be having two boys. And they raised these two boys there, which also makes me feel good. Being like, okay, they were able to survive there with a baby and a toddler and whatever. But the photos the inspector sent, because the home photos when I bought it were like immaculate. He must have caught them on a rough day. Because it was like just every day, all the photos just had everyday clutter. Like the kitchen was covered in cups and like all this shit. And actually made
that's
me,
real life.
It was like real life photos of the house. It wasn't disgusting, but it was like there was some clothes thrown over the couch and toys everywhere and blah, blah, blah. And it actually made me feel good to see it lived in.
I
and
can
like
be dirty
livable.
Too.
I wish every house came with photos of like, here's the photos of it immaculate when you move in. But here's also how it looked when we were like really living in it on a Wednesday on a school night. Like here's the, I don't know.
True. That's the night that it needs to be.
Yeah.
And not only am I going through that, but I'm a big time spyer. I don't know if you guys do this, but I have Blink cameras and Simply Safe cameras all over my house. Not Blink, Simply Safe. So the Simply Safes are all over and I can record for like 1 minute clips and it's in 4K. It's amazing. Like to have all those. So I have it on super sensitive mode right now. So if you fart, like the camera turns on, essentially.
Yeah.
So I've been going through and watching like what's been going on because in Texas it's a one-party consent state. Like all I have to do is mine. So I've been these realtors don't know shit, man. There's so many realtors that have no idea. One walked into the back of my pool house and like all the big pool equipment's there. It's like a gas heater. It's a big-ass nice pump. And then there's a normal water heater that's outside that, spoiler alert, heats the water in the shower in the pool house. The realtor comes out and he's like, oh yeah, this is a bigger tank. It's a 45-gallon water tank. It's a 55-gallon water tank. And then he goes, this is the water that they – this water heater is the one that heats the jacuzzi. Like, that's not possible for a water heater to do that. You have to have like a huge gas – whatever, I can see I lost you guys already. But it drove me fucking bananas this
weekend. Oh, it's got to be hard to watch that, yeah.
When they're like, oh, this shower, I'm not sure if it runs. I'm like, it does run, and it's a steam shower. That's the reason why the fucking head looks different. So many things that were in our house, like the nicest features of our house. The guy goes, it's a quarter of an acre lot. Like, it's literally double and then some.
Well,
that's
tell you what,
important.
What I think we've seen in the last handful of years, especially since COVID, with all the shows on Netflix and Bravo about real estate that look real flashy, they're like, and they flash like the commission on the screen, and they don't get into the details on how that commission gets chopped up. People see real estate now recently as a job that's like, oh, I'll just start doing real estate and I'm going to be a millionaire in a week.
Yep.
And they don't realize like how much work goes into it. So what you're getting, Chaps,
and
is
how much
a lot of these realtors
fucking lie, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they lie not, about not, all not that lie shit. So much, not so lie so much as mislead.
No,
I
agree,
say.
Lie.
No, I saw there was just this big article about the, what's the one with all the fancy people with Chrishell and all that?
Oh, Selling Sunset?
None of those commissions are like none of it's like all like.
Yeah.
But
so regardless,
know.
But yeah. What I think, Chaps, is you get a lot of people that aren't the listing agent on your house that are just representing their client. They come to your house for the first time, don't do any of their homework, so they don't know any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just infuriating to watch, and because I'm like sitting there, and it wouldn't be bad, you know, like if I was an aspire, so I'm kind of doing it to myself, because otherwise nothing really matters what they're saying unless an offer comes across. Anyway, we'll be back next week. Hopefully I have an offer in hand because I'm stressed out beyond belief. We'll see you then. Sound the retreat. Now on Zero Block 30, I'm privileged to have Tom Hanton. He's got an incredible bio. The things that he's doing for the veteran community. It is the 50th anniversary of the last of the Vietnam prisoners of war coming home. And that's why we're having on the show. He is going to tell us about some of those events that's going on that happened to him and kind of what he's doing after his service in the military is over. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Let's get into what you kind of did in the Air Force. You're a pilot. Can you tell us a little bit about the plane that you flew?
I was a backseater in the F-4.
Okay.
And that's what I was shot down in 1972, June 27th, to be specific. I was on my 135th combat mission, arriving in Vietnam, Da Nang Air Base on the 1st of February. So 5 months, I flew 135 missions, which was pretty much every day. When I returned home, I was medically grounded for about a year, during which time I got a master's degree in business at Arizona State University. When I was returned to flying status, I went into the F-105G, which is a wild weasel. I'm not sure if your audience is familiar with that airplane.
Probably not. Maybe so. We have a lot of aviation heads, too.
Right. So I was in the wild weasel business after the war, after the Vietnam War, and then went into a new version of the F-4, the F-4G, as an initial flight instructor in that airplane. I'd say the first half of my career, which is roughly 12 years, I was in 25. I was in the flying world, active flying squadrons, primarily in the Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. The second half of my career, I was in operational staffs at the Pentagon and a NATO assignment in New Germany, back to the States in another operational staff, and then back to Europe again in an Air Force assignment. I retired in 1993 as a director of electronic combat at the Air Force Operational Test and Evaluation Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico at Kirtland Air Force Base. So 25 years in the Air Force, focused primarily on operations, either active flying or staffs that did the planning and the tasking and that type of stuff.
Okay. And I'm sure that with your 25 years career, and we talked to, there's a World War II veteran that we talked to, Stanley Rubin, and he talked about his time on Iwo Jima and how whenever he spoke to somebody, they always wanted to talk about Iwo Jima. And I'm sure when you talk about your military career, even though it was very successful, you got to the rank of lieutenant colonel, spent 25 years, they primarily want to talk about those 275 days that you were a prisoner of war. But before we get into that, I want to talk about those 135 different missions that you flew, because that's a ton. How did you get up for those every day? Because I'm sure they're incredibly stressful. Your day-to-day, knowing that you're going to have to go back out and do it again, what was that like for you?
Well, as you know, anyone who's been in the military, you train and you train and you train, you do a lot of training. And then many people don't go into a combat situation, even though it seems to have changed in modern times, so there seems to always be combat going on somewhere. Mm-hmm. But you train, and so I've always felt confident, certainly after the first few. In February of 72, it was fairly a benign environment. That's if those listeners remember or are aware of President Nixon's goal of ending the Vietnam War and bringing the prisoners of war home. There was not a lot of ground operations going on at the time. So I got used to flying in a fairly benign environment. So it wasn't quite as stressful as going right into North Vietnam and having surface air missiles fired at us and MiGs attacking us, et cetera. So the first couple of months, it was fairly, I don't want to say routine. Combat's not routine. We lost airplanes and we did lose people. Flying into the ground, and there was small arms fire in Laos and along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which is what we've focused on initially. I guess I was just motivated enough that I never really, I didn't worry about it particularly. And oddly enough, I felt confident flying over South Vietnam, where we were supporting the ARVN, the South Vietnamese Army, with close air support, or we were bombing things on the trail, which the North Vietnamese were still bringing supplies down through the Ho Chi Minh Trail from North Vietnam down through Laos, Cambodia, and into the southern part of Vietnam. I felt confident and safe there, oddly enough. But when you look at the stats of how many people we lost in South Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia versus how many of those guys came home, and I say guys because back in those days it was all men mm-hmm. flying, it was actually less safe. It was actually, you had a higher probability of coming home if you were shot down over North Vietnam than you were in the South. So I don't know, I was motivated because I felt confidence in the people I was flying with, and the war wasn't that intense until March, end of March, when the North Vietnamese Army literally marched down over across the DMZ with tanks and the whole entourage of an army. Then it got a little more tense. Yes, I was a little more concerned about that. And then we started flying over North Vietnam again in April. And it was frightening the first few times. I will not lie about that. But your confidence improves as you succeed in those missions. So, and I had been in the F4 a year, almost 2 years before I went to Vietnam. So I was a fairly skilled person in that airplane.
And isn't that something that you have the difference between being confident and complacent? Like if you have those two different things, walking the line right in the middle is exactly where you kind of want to be, where you aren't nervous about doing things. You have a little bit of nerves, but you're not overwhelmed by that. But you're very cognizant of the risk that's there. That's kind of where you want to be. Is that where you're at the day that you got shot down?
Well, you know, it's one of those, when you speak to people that have been shot down, it's kind of interesting. Today, when I talk to some of my friends, I either forgot their story or maybe I never dwelt on it. And during our recent reunion, I had a couple of conversations with guys I've known for quite some time, but never really examined or discussed our shoot downs. Hmm. And of course, 50 years ago when we returned, that's one of those numbers that's a little bit shocking.
Yeah.
And I it seems like more and more people I've talked about when they're shooting down, something was out of the ordinary. It was not normal. And that is exactly what happened the day I was shot down. I was flying with, it was a four ship of F4s. I had never flown with any of those other nine people in those airplanes. If I did the math correctly, I had never flown with these other seven guys. It was seven of them. They were in a totally different squadron that had been attached to ours. So I was thrown into a flight of four people that I didn't know. So the tactics and all the rest of that stuff was different. So I hadn't, quote, practiced, if you will, with any of these guys. And it throws timing off and all those kind of decisions that one would make. And that has happened. I mean, I talked to so many guys that it seems like it was an out of the ordinary situation. And mistakes may have been made, or the timing. And when you're flying airplanes, you know, seconds are there's a lot of time, believe it or not.
Oh, I bet. And that's an interesting, I've never even thought about that, of how even flying together, you have to have kind of like a platoon, essentially, where you know where the other part's going to be, yeah. Where going in, like breaching a house, for example, going in, stacking up, you need to know where everybody's going to go. They need to know where you're at. I never thought about it being the same thing for pilots in planes.
Yeah, absolutely the same. We used to fly, I used to fly with a regular, in the F-4, it was a two-place airplane, and you flew as a crew. And typically you flew with other members of your flight, which is smaller than a platoon. I think a platoon is, what, about 100 guys?
39. About,
yes. So we tend to fly in two-ship or four-ship formations. And so in a typical Air Force flight, I can't remember how many people we had in that, quote, flight, but on the ground, we're organized as a squadron with four flights. And, you know, there's maybe 15, 20 guys in a flight, if it's that many.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
So you're on your way. You're paired up with a group that you hadn't been paired for. And then what happened?
Well, we had a successful escort. We were a MiG escort that day in F-4Es. And the F-4E had a nose gun, a 20-millimeter nose gun, and we carried four heat-seeking missiles and four radar-directed missiles. And we were escorting the bombing aircraft of the day. There was a target near Hanoi, a military target. It was a either a tank or a truck repair facility south of the city. And we were successful in that mission, and expended no ordnance. There were no MiGs up that day, and at least that time of the day. However, during that raid, by the second, there was two raids. The second raid, they lost an F-4, and they were on a search and rescue mission. They set up a search and rescue mission, and since we were fully ordnanced, we were diverted to support it to prevent any MiGs from attacking the helicopters and the Sandys, which were A-1, they're propeller-driven rescue airplanes that forward air controllers that they would find and locate the downed crew and then bring in the helicopters. So we were going to support that kind of operation, which we did. We went in about three different times. And on the third time, we'd gotten to be very predictable. And the tactics that were used weren't really ideal. When you do a MiG cap, you don't usually have four airplanes all tied together. You split people up so you can look out and see around. You're not trying to fly a formation of four airplanes. You're out only flying off of one other person. That was a mistake that was made. Years later, in fact, 2018, I met the MiG 21 pilot who shot me down.
Wow.
In San Diego. Some Navy friends of mine hosted these MiG 21, MiG 17 pilots on an exchange of, I don't want to say reconciliation, but they wanted to get to know people who they had air combat with. Anyway, so when I had that meeting with the MiG 21 pilot, we discussed my shoot down. Well, it was fairly straightforward what they did. He came, he was the flight lead of this two ship of MiG 21s and their tactic at the time was, do not engage in F-4s because we a good F-4 pilot could beat them. And they did not want, they had a very limited number of airplanes. So what they would do is they would wait until you got into a compromised formation, and they would come behind you from below, typically out of the valley, and they would pull their airplane up and fire a missile at you, a heat-seeking missile. So we had no warnings. They would not use their radars, and they would just, and this MiG-21 is a small aircraft compared to the F-4. Plus, we were smoked. The F-4 smoked, the engine smoked, so you had a trail of smoke coming out of the tail of the airplane, which made it pretty easy to see from below. And it was a clear day, so that's what he did. He and his wingmen, they pulled up below us, and we were lagging in the flight because of this difficulty in flying a four-ship formation in a MIGCAP. So we were a little bit out of position, and they took advantage of it because the rest of the flight had lost contact with us visually. At any rate, I asked him what his flight was like, this MiG-21 pilot. I wanted to know what they had done to shoot us down. We'd been directed toward MiGs at least on two of the times we were in on this MIGCAP. What we did was we'd circle for a while, and we get low on gas, and we go out to the tanker, and then we come back. So we did that three times. So I asked him what happened. Well, every time they tried to come toward us, we were directed to turn towards them, and they would land, basically. So they landed twice at different airfields in North Vietnam, refueled and got back into alert status, waiting to be launched at us if we came within intercept range. Essentially, that's what they were doing. They were intercepting us. They weren't dogfighting us. They were intercepting us. Anyway, on the third time, we were out of position. Of course, we'd done the same circuit two previous times, so we were very predictable. And so their timing was such, they just came right at us and shot us down. In fact, they shot two airplanes down, which something I didn't learn until later on, that they'd shot number three, and I said number four aircraft. So they shot three and four, our element shot down.
And when that happens and you get shot down, what does it feel like inside the plane? And what was your first initial reaction?
Well, you go on automatic pilot almost in that type of situation. I mean, we are trained on how to position ourselves to eject, et cetera. Well, what happens when a heat-seeking missile went up into the left engine of the two-engine F-4, it exploded, and it was like the end of the back end of the airplane had come off. It literally went into a what they call a skid, and then a out of control, because the hydraulics of the F-4 run right down the middle between the two engines, and when one of them explodes, it cuts all those lines, so you lose control over the flight controls, the rudder and the ailerons and all that, the stabilator in the back. So the airplane goes out of control. Well, what it did is went into a spin, and of course it's rattling people around inside this airplane because it's not flying smoothly. It's spinning.
Yeah, imagine.
I didn't know that until I came back and went. I didn't tell until I went to pilot training what a spin felt like. And that anyway, that's what it was doing. It was spinning, and we were trained in the F-4 to. At a certain altitude above the ground, you would bail out if you did not have control of the airplane. Well, I reached down. The F-4, the Navy Air Force had flight controls in the back seat, so you could fly the airplane from the back seat, which all of us did. I felt the stick of the airplane, and it was not attached. It was like it was not attached. Well, basically, there was no hydraulics that to allow the stick to control the airplane. So I got in position to bail out, and I don't know if I pulled my ejection handle or whether the front seater did, but we went out, and it got real quiet, real fast. Like I said, it's automatic, and I'm in the chute. It was a fairly violent ejection. And normally In fact, you always have your helmet and your mask, your oxygen mask, as tight as you can stand it, because, and the same thing, you have the visor down so that you protect yourself. Well, it was such a violent ejection, it ripped the helmet off. And I had a custom-made helmet, which fit better than the standard one. So it was quite surprising that when I was in the chute and looked up, and of course I could tell my helmet was gone, and make sure I had a good parachute, which I did. So I went out 10,000 feet roughly above the earth. We were at, I don't know, 25,000 feet or thereabouts when we got hit. And I don't remember, I think it was like 16,000 feet on the altimeter when I bailed out. And next thing I know, I'm looking down at a village, and a karst, that's a high mountain peak thing that sticks up out of the valley. There's several of them around the area. And I am steering my parachute. There's a mechanism, a way to cut the lines with a lanyard, and you can steer your parachute a little better. So I did that, and I was going towards this karst because I didn't want to go down to the village. And there's some guys down in the three peasants down the far end of this rice paddy that had rifles. They were shooting at me. So I didn't have any choice. I couldn't continue going over them. I went the opposite direction, which was towards that village. And some a stand of bamboo. It looked fairly thick from the air, but when I got down into it, when I landed, it was not very thick. They pretty much cleaned that place out, leaving a little bit of bamboo, but they used that bamboo for their hooches and, you know, implements and things like that. At any rate, so for about an hour, I was able to hide from them, but they knew the area. And
before we can continue there, I want to talk about some of your emotions in that moment, because you're talking about it really matter of factly now. When you realize that your helmet is gone and the situation that is about to take Kirk, because you know what's going on in Vietnam, I'm sure you've had all the different safety briefs, the intel briefs about what to do. How much were you kind of freaking out, for lack of a better term, freaking out in your brain? And then also going back to your training and kind of having to center yourself again, what was that process like?
Well, I was very unhappy. First of all, yeah. I mean, I was literally, in fact, I wrote something, I said, I was angry. I was upset because I knew that my flying was probably over, even though we were on a rescue mission that I, you know, had hope of getting rescued. I know I was in shock. Later on, I saw a picture that they took of me when I got to the Hilton about 3 days later, and I looked like my eyes are the size of saucers. I mean, I was just, I'm sure I was in some kind of shock. And you work on auto, like I said earlier, autopilot. You just do these things that you were trained to do, you know, cutting the parachute thing and run. But I was, oddly enough, I was angry. And in fact, I titled this paper I wrote, A Time to Shout, because I was just, I knew that the errors had been made. And I was upset at myself for not being more directive and telling people what to do, you know, in that formation. You know, you look back at those things, but I know I was in shock. And that's why you know, military things, a lot of it is rote. I've not been a ground guy, but I can only imagine what it's like when you get attacked by people. I mean, you go into this mode of operation that you're trained to be in. I guess the best word I can use is I was just in shock. And I was thinking reasonably clear, I felt at the time, for, you know, the circumstances as they were presented me, the guys coming after me and this and that. But it was a helpless feeling because there was nowhere close for me really to get. If I could have gotten to that mountain or that karst, I probably would have had a better chance of being rescued and returning to the fight, so to speak. But I think it was a frustrating and anger filled And helplessness. Yeah. Helplessness. Yeah. I'd say helpless was probably the best word I can come up with.
Yeah. And that's what I was just going to say. Like, I have been injured in war as well. And there's almost no way to describe that feeling. English is a very complex, then we steal from all different types of languages across, but there is nothing that describes that level of fear inside the language. It's almost impossible. So when you landed and you go through the bamboo, what happens next?
I was there probably in an app, but I found one place that seemed like it was safe to hide. And that's when I didn't hear anybody coming around. So I pulled out my survival radio and had it down. I turned it all the way down as far as I before on the volume, because I knew these guys could probably hear it. And I was listening with up to my ear, and I could hear this rescue going on. Well, obviously they were working on getting my front seater, which they ended up rescuing. They did rescue him. And that's when I learned that there was a second airplane shot down. On that radio call, I made a radio transmission, but I never got an answer. And then I went quiet again, because I wanted to make sure these guys weren't, I wanted to hear where they were. And it didn't take them long to find this one hiding place in this small area of bamboo between the fields there, the rice paddies. And they captured me and took me up into that area, oddly enough, that karst, because they could hear, and I could hear the rescue going on the other side of that karst. As it turns out, two things of interest to that day. To the North Vietnamese, that was one of their big days of shooting down the most F-4s in the whole war, five of them. They'd shot five airplanes down with various and sundry other, SAMs and other types of airplanes, but never five F-4s with just MiGs shooting them down. So their Air Force had a very successful day. So that was a big deal for them in the war. That was one of the reasons that that MiG pilot wanted to talk to those of us that were shot down that day, because it was a big deal for them. Second thing about that day, it was one of the third, for the rescue forces, it was one of the third most notable rescues of the two pilots. They rescued the two pilots, and the two of us backseaters both got captured. And why was it such an important thing for the rescue guys? The ground fire was so intense that one of the helicopters that was picking up my front seater, they got shot up so bad they had to depart and leave the pararescue guy on the ground. Jeez. And he had to haul my front seater, who had passed out from the ejection, he and his ground impact, dragged this guy through about 200 yards of bamboo and just rough terrain. In fact, that pararescue guy got the Air Force Cross, which is one below to the Medal of Honor for that mission. So for the rescue guys, it was a big deal. They had a couple others that you may or may not be aware of in the 72 that were quite notable. The one of them was Roger Locker, who was on the ground for 26 days or thereabouts. And the other one was a one down by the DMZ that I participated in, of an EB-66 navigator who was surrounded by North Vietnam Army. And I forget how many rescue people they lost airplane wise on that rescue. So those, and of course, the one I just mentioned of our flight, Valiant, was our flight call sign, was their third biggest deal. So it's kind of an interesting day, to say the least. Yeah.
And when did hope, I mean, I hate to use that word, but when you're sitting there waiting to know if you're going to get captured or if they're going to rescue you, how did that go down? Like, when the people came in to actually capture you, what did that scene look like? And for those that are listening, Tom told me I could ask anything and I don't want to be insensitive, but what was that moment like when you knew for a fact you were about to be a prisoner of war?
Well, I tell you, I as I mentioned earlier, I was in shock, of course. That was the most, they beat me with their rifle butts. That was the harshest I was treated through my whole POW experience. In 72, they were not torturing like they were doing prior to 69. They were seriously maltreated prisoners. I did not experience that, but I had a, I guess a loss of, you know, it really is over. I think I was probably during the time I was in hiding, thinking that there was a chance that these guys wouldn't find me and that I could get rescued and rejoin my squadron. But when they were there, you know, face to face, and they were probably more frightened than I was, the way the looks on their faces and, you know, pointing their rifles at me. It was just it's a sense of hopelessness. It's like, okay, how could it possibly get out of this? Will there be an opportunity to escape? Well, I don't know. So, you know, they teach us that to, you know, don't give up, which I didn't, but it was a hopeless feeling that I don't think there's going to be a real good opportunity to escape, but we'll have to see how this goes. And I just was taking it one moment at a time.
And that aspect, after they did, whenever you did get picked up, did you walk to your prisoner of war camp? Did you ride? And if so, what was that walk or ride like?
Well, what they did is they took me up into that karst area that I was initially trying to steer toward.
Mm-hmm.
And they walked me. The first thing they did is they took my boots and my flight suit and all my gear. It was a seat kit it's like a bunch of survival stuff. And we had a survival vest. So they took all those things and I was in my skivvies. And at the time they left me with my socks. So we walked over there and up a stream in this karst, and we could hear the air battle going on across the other way. But we stayed there until it was dark pretty much. So I was shot down around noon and captured about one. My watch was also, which was very kind of curious, my watch was also stripped off my arm when I ejected. So I didn't know roughly, it was roughly an hour. So we were there from about 1 or 2 in the afternoon until it started getting dark. So we were back up in that dark, up in that creek for about 6 hours or so. And they moved me in the twilight, if you will, towards another village. Oddly enough, the village that was closest to the rice paddy, there were several hooches on fire because it was close to the rescue part, and they were the rescue forces, I guess, there was some small arms fire coming from them, from the village, and so they took it out. And I'm thinking, oh, this is great. These guys are going to be really happy now. Their houses are on fire and they're taking me where? So I was concerned about making it to a pre-OW camp at that point. But anyway, we walked to the next village, a village further down somewhere in close vicinity, and they tied me up. All these hooches were raised, so probably because it's in a valley and would flood. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we were up in there and they tied me down in there at night. Next day, we walked all day and met, at the end of that day, we met a Jeep, a Russian Jeep on the road.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Did anybody speak English or was everybody just essentially yelling at you in Vietnamese?
Nope, they were more curious. I felt like I was a person in a zoo, if you will. They were kind of curious about this person. I knew a little French and I was thirsty and I asked for water. And they, oddly enough, we had a water can in this survival kit. They actually gave it to me to open. Well, it was the old kind of, it came with one of those, I don't know, those can openers. Back in the day, you'd open beer with a thing. It didn't have a pop top.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
they actually gave me that thing to open the water and let me drink it. I mean, I was surprised that they would do that. But anyway, nobody spoke English. And of course, I didn't speak any Vietnamese. And they would just, you know, kind of motion to do things. And I would do them, which was mainly, you know, give them the hands and tie me up and that kind of thing. But while I was walking, they had me tied with my hands behind me, behind my back. And there'd be a guy in front of me and one behind me, and I don't know how many more behind them. But we met regular army people in this on this dirt road, and we were about 80 miles from Hanoi, very close to the Laotian border. So I walked one day, and then one more day in the jeep to get to Hanoi, one overnight in another village, and I felt comfortable once I was in the hands of the army, because now I'm in, quote, the system, and I wasn't as worried about somebody, you know, doing away with me out there in the middle of nowhere land. I think what they had is a bounty on our heads if somebody would turn us in. I would suspect if there hadn't been a bounty on our head from the government, they probably would have. Maybe, you know, what's in it for them? I mean, I think about it. If
right.
You were there and somebody bombs your house, are you going to be real happy with these people?
Right, because they're walking too. Like, and they don't want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So once I was in the hands of the military, I felt a little more comfortable. Of course, I'd had, you know, almost 48 hours to think about the situation then. And I was still...
Which had to feel like 10 years. Those 48 hours, you know, had to feel like 10 years.
You know, we're told... Once they had my radio, I wasn't too concerned about the fact they had my 38 handgun. I mean, that was nice to have, but almost useless in many regards. Once they had the radio, I knew the probability of being rescued was about zero. So escaping, if I were to escape, where would I go? What would I do? I just, you know, I lost the opportunity early on. Once they had me in their grasp and had my radio, I lost comms, and to get in touch with anybody's, you know, just zero. So I just I had to start accepting the fact that I was going to be a prisoner and to not do anything stupid to get either shot or whatever. There's still an enemy, and with, you know, with the errant soldier, you never know. Just because you've got a couple guys with guns around you and they're in the army doesn't mean they're going to follow the rules.
Right. And so when you're walking through and you finally get to Hanoi, was there anyone there that kind of took you under your wing, or was you in solitary for a while? How did that first day go for you?
Well, I got there the end of the day. So it was night, essentially getting dark. I was in this jeep blindfolded and tied up. So, but I had worked the blindfold down so I could kind of move my head and see a little bit. I saw the Hanoi Hilton, which you see pictures of today. That was the vision that I saw out of the corner of my eye going in there. And of course, once you're in the city, it was very, you could hear all the traffic and the, you know, people moving around out there. But once we got inside that prison, it was dead quiet. And they put me into a room, took off my blindfold, and it was basically in a interrogation room. And that's where I stayed for about 3 weeks on and off. It was a room that was primarily used for interrogation, but they had put one of these, it's like a bed. It was a wooden bed on the floor, no legs, basically a platform. And that was the bed, and nothing in there but the table and the chair for the interrogators, and then a stool for me. And they'd come in. It had a light bulb that would run 24/7. The windows were shuttered and wired shut, so you couldn't open them. You could kind of look down and see out, but you couldn't see much anything except the ground. Anyway, I was in there for about 3 weeks through various interrogations, day and night, and of course, initially they wanted military information, which it sounds crazy, but I didn't have any. I was thrown in with these guys. I didn't have a clue what, you know, so I played I played dumb. And it was true. I didn't know any of their names, even. I couldn't come up with names. And they thought I was just being whatever. And I should have made up names, but then I wouldn't remember what names I made up, you know, like Mickey Mouse and all those other
kind of things. Right.
Thinking back, I said, why didn't I have the nerve to do that or the thought to do that? I was trying to, and they believed me. They finally gave up on that.
And that's the second time you've mentioned something like that. Did you, hindsight bias is a big thing in Monday morning quarterbacking. And I always talk about that with my injury where if I could go back, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? Why didn't I take this step? Why did I take that? What would have happened if this happened? How often did you find yourself Monday morning quarterbacking and almost blaming yourself for this horrific accident?
Probably more times than I can recall, but yes, I actually, after a while, I did start being a little more bold. Primarily after I was put in with other people, then I knew that there's still no guarantees because I had made no contact with anyone on the radio. Or in person, I would try to tap on the wall. We had the tap code that we'd learned to tap. It wasn't Morse code. It was similar, but you tap on the walls and you try to get in touch with people. But I wasn't close to any of the normal cells. I was off in this, I'll call it administrative area, not the proper prison part. And so I was a little bit, you know, I wasn't, I use whenever I give a talk, I said, I was either the teacher's pet. This was in school. I was either the teacher's pet or their worst nightmare. I could be the one. And, back when I went to school, if you acted up and I went to Catholic schools, the nuns would wrap you on the wrist with their, or on the knuckles with a ruler or make embarrass you by making you stand in the back of the room or right on the blackboard, I will not talk in class 25 times, etc. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so when I got into a more formal environment, the second guessing stopped. I would start doing things to harass them, if you will, jokes or whatever, just things, obstinate things. If they wanted me to do something, I'd do it the opposite way or fumble around and do this and that, knowing that they weren't going to beat me, because I knew that in that time frame, 1972, they weren't doing that kind of stuff. They did rough some folks up. I do know that. I'm aware of that. But I felt confident that I could get away with these things. So, yes, I did second guess a lot of the early things, you know, the shoot down. Why didn't I get on the radio more? And why didn't I do this and that, et cetera? There's not much I could do about that rescue. You know, I tried, I did everything I could do to try to be quiet and to use the radio. I did make a couple radio calls, but got no response, probably because I wasn't line of sight with anybody. That cars was in the way and they were on the opposite side of it. But as far as the actual capture and all that, I didn't do a lot of second guessing, to be honest with you. Same thing with the interrogation. We got very good training in when I went through survival school, because people had come back from Vietnam. Some of the prisoners had been released early, and they did give some good information to our survival school people on what to expect. So the training that I got was pretty good on how to respond to interrogation. And the mock interrogations that we had taught me a lot. So I felt pretty good about the interrogation part and how to, I don't say parry with them and try to do the, you know, the only thing that was difficult was they trying to come up with names. I didn't have any names, but yeah, that second guessing I would love to, because I've heard of guys doing stuff like that. I did do some fun and some interesting things after a while as my interrogators drug on and on. And what I told them, they'd ask me some question and I'd lead them down some rabbit hole of, you know, I'd get what I did and didn't do in the Air Force. You know, I'd start instructing them on how to be a navigator and all this kind of stuff. And they'd write all this stuff down. I'd just keep going and giving him information of inconsequential information. But yes, second guessing is a good thing.
And was there ever a point in those 275 days where you almost came resigned, where this became the new normal? And if so, how long did that take?
Well, it'd be very easy. And we did have a couple guys in our group that just had a hard time of it, being locked up like that. As we mentioned before we started the conversation here about guys that have been there, like Ev Alvarez, 8.5 years he was there. Of course, at that time, it had been 7 years. And I would think, I'm alive. I was very blessed. I wasn't injured. Superficial injuries, no serious injuries compared to some people. So I knew that, and my dad was in the military, so I was very used to having my life changed overnight, lose all your friends and go to a new base, etc. So I was used to having those kind of things, and I could adapt to them really well. That I viewed that prisoner situation very similarly, that first of all, I'm not hurt. There's guys that are worse off. One of my first cellmates had a really broken up shoulder from hitting the canopy rail as he bailed out of the F4. In fact, he ended up.
I mean, if you ripped your helmet off and watch off, I can't imagine if.
Yeah, but it was shoulder. Just other than wind blast to my eye, I had no real. I was flailed around and had some sore knees and all, but nothing broken, and so I felt I'm a glass is half full kind of person to start with. So I'd try to focus on these good things, not the bad part. I mean, you can say, oh, and that's what would become depressing for some of these guys. You just have to try to boost their outlook. So I just took it one day at a time too. I just knew, hey, that I'm not, and I'm a routine. I develop a routine of some sort, you know, like the military, you get up, you make your bed, you do your PT, you say your prayers, all these things that occupy your time. And fortunately, once you're in with a group of people, and on average, I had four cellmates and of different backgrounds, just learning about their lives. And, you know, some guys are very good at remembering jokes, for example. I can't remember a joke at all. So some guy would be able to tell jokes all day or half the day, or guys remember movies and things like that, or singers, or we talk about cars or stuff like that. Rarely did we talk about food, but
because it makes you want it. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it's a developing routine. And I don't know. I grew up in the military, so I was used to change. Sometimes it would be 3 years. Sometimes it'd be 1 year. You never knew when your dad was going to get a change of assignment. And I went to 4 different high schools, for example. I was used to change and having new situations. So I don't want to say it was easy, but it was not as difficult for me as it was for some people.
And I'm sure that the information that you're getting inside from the American perspective or what's going on, did you get a whole lot of news that updates, or were you kind of flying blind and you didn't know what was going on?
Well, we get news, but it was usually bad news. What they would do is they would take American magazines, cut out whatever bad things were going on. For those who are familiar with the 70s, early 70s and late 60s, it was anti-war this and all this, you know, the race riots going on here and there in the U.S., et cetera. So we would get all the news like as if our country was coming apart at the seams. And essentially, they were giving us, I considered it propaganda, because it was obviously it was certainly trying to make us feel negative about our country. Basically, we would get I think it was about an hour a day. We have these speakers in the cells, and they would we'd hear people like anti-war people that were either visiting Vietnam or were in the U.S. giving speeches. We would get
like Jane Fonda,
precisely. Well, I got so sick of hearing that. She was over there in August when I first got out of solitary. And we were by that time, I think we were over at the zoo one of the big prison camps that's in Hanoi. And I shimmied up this pipe and to the top of this pipe and ripped out the speaker wires because I got so sick and tired of hearing that kind of stuff. Of course, we did get some good stuff over there, which was music. And I told the guy, I guess I should have asked you before I went up there and got rid of our sound box. But anyway, yes, those kind of things, they would try to demoralize you. I just ignored most of all that stuff and just, you know, I knew what it was all about.
And that seems like an extra weight. Like for somebody like you that is a admitted half glass full person, there has to be half empty people. And then if I know that personality type, because I'm kind of that personality too, you feel like you have to lift the people up that are down. So you're taking on an extra emotional toll there to make sure that the people to your left and right aren't in the dips of despair like they normally would be.
Well, absolutely. And the other part is we maintained a military structure, if you will. I was the senior ranking young captain. The other two of the guys in the room were lieutenants, and the other ones were captains. For at least, I'd say about half the time I was there, I was the senior ranking guy. So there was that additional part. And unlike some of the other services, the Air Force, just because you're a captain doesn't mean you're like a company commander would be in the Army.
Right.
Or as a lieutenant. So the Air Force doesn't, we had fewer responsible positions where you had to lead people, lead men. So I'd never been a leader of anything. I had just been promoted to captain. And your flight commanders tended to be senior captains and sometimes majors. And now I'm in charge of these guys. There's like eight of us. And I'm inexperienced really, other than my officer candidate school or officer training school stuff. So I had no experience as a leader, to be quite honest with you. It was kind of somewhat intimidating because two of the guys in my group were Air Force Academy graduates and they had a lot of experience. But here I am, I outranked them. So I mean, we didn't march around and do stuff like that. But the point was I didn't have a lot of experience, right, basically. And we did act as a team still. And some of the things we would do, they did not like it. They didn't use rank, but when we were out in the yard, on our break, you know, they let us out of the cells for a few hours in the morning, a few hours in the afternoon to do things and sit around and whatever. And they wanted you to do something. They would tell one of the guys to do something. They'd say, go ask Captain Hanton. to tell us to do that. They didn't like that at all. But that was one of the ways we resisted.
And that seems pretty common story that you have to adapt and have to have come up with some kind of normalcy in your structure to make it day-to-day bearable at all. So you have all this information, you have the propaganda that's coming in from people like Jane Fonda, and then eventually you get the word. The word has to come out that the war is over. When you first, who delivered that news to you all, and how did that come about?
Well, when they signed the peace agreement in Paris, the stipulation was that we had to be informed within so many days. And they would read, Northeast had to read and provide us the copy of this peace agreement. So we were all, this was in late January of 73. And they had an auditorium in the zoo. That's where I was. They moved us back and forth. But at that point, we were back in the zoo from Hanoi Hilton. And one evening, they took us all from all of the other buildings, and there was six buildings at the zoo, as I recall. They took us all in this auditorium. There's probably maybe 100 guys in there. And of course they took us, they stood up in front of us on the stage and read the peace agreement had been signed and what the rules were as far as release. And it all had to be done by within 2 months, February and March, etc. So, and nobody stood up and clapped or did anything. We just kind of took that in stride and went back to our rooms, and the process started. Of course, immediately the food improved, and we started getting Red Cross packages with books, American books, not this propaganda books, that Russian books that they would pass out on occasion for us to read. And so it's life got better. And of course, it's not over until it's over. And being the end, the way the release was going to take place would be by shoot down, order of shoot down. In other words, the first guy shot down would come home first, along with anyone who was seriously injured. And there were some few guys, particularly the B-52 guys. There was a number of them that had been seriously injured when they bailed out of those B-52s in December. And my cellmate, Chuck, who was had that beat up shoulder, he was deemed. Now it was up to the Vietnamese to deem who was going home, quote, who was injured, not us. They didn't come ask us, but they selected the people to go home early on the first. I think it was all those guys that were injured went home on the first flight.
In that, when you first leave the auditorium, was there any thought that you had that this is just another propaganda machine, that they're doing this to get our hopes up and then to emotionally crush us?
No, actually we didn't, but we were very cautious showing emotion, whether it's happy emotion or sad emotion. We never did display. I never remember anyone showing any elation or anything regarding that announcement. I think we all knew, because, you know, in 72, we knew that what Nixon was doing, he was ending the war and bringing POWs home. So we already kind of up there at that level.
Hockey is on. And no matter the city, no matter the team, no matter the game, whether it's face-off or penalty shots, regular season or playoffs, win or lose, no matter what happens, no matter where it happens, New Amsterdam Vodka is there.
But we also knew that things had changed throughout the war on this negotiating thing. Now, when the B-52s came over and they moved us from the zoo back to the Hanoi Hilton, they put us in a large room with about 26 guys in it, and they did not realize that there was a new guy in there already in this big room. He was a Navy lieutenant that had been shot down early. He was so early, you weren't allowed to have facial hair. Let's put it that way. It was something that they didn't say. He hadn't even shaved his mustache off. So we picked his brain all night about what was going on, because I mean, I'd been there 6 months already by that time, along with most of the guys in my group. Well, we learned what was going on. You know, it kind of updated us on the status of things. The B-52s came back. You know, they thought there was going to be an agreement met, and then they reneged on it. And that's when the bus went back in there in December. We did have some concern because the bombing had stopped. And we thought, oh, great, it's over. We're going to be going home. And then it kept dragging on. And finally back, a couple of months later in December, it heated back up again. So anyway, we're talking to this guy, and his name, oddly enough, was also Tom, about what was going on. And he filled us in on all this stuff. So when the announcement came, about 3 weeks later, we didn't feel like it was a head fake on it. We felt like this, okay. They tried to get away with once the B-50s went in and flattened them, and now they really are serious, and this is for real. But it's not over until you're out of there. And of course, the first release was literally about 2 weeks after that.
Wow.
Middle of February was the first release, and three C-141s. So when we saw those C-141s come in, because where we were at the zoo, you could see them come in. We could see them across the wall from where our building was. So we knew at least the first release was going on according to schedule. And they had a few glitches, but they got, by the end of March when I went out, 28th of March, until we were in international airspace, and the aircraft commander of that C-141 said, "We're in international airspace, everybody." And you've seen that picture. For some reason, that picture of all of us shouting, that was the flight I was on about all these flights. For some reason, it seems to make publishing things. But anyway, yeah.
My experience, not even trying to remotely compare, but that feeling when you leave a combat zone, we left Fallujah and went into Spangalem, Germany. And I remember the relief of stepping off the plane and having my feet hit really a safe territory for the first time. I imagine that feeling for you was exponentially more than what I experienced. When you finally put your feet back on American soil, what was that feeling of relief like? And did it feel like I have life and I'm going to be able to continue to be Tom?
Yeah. Well, it started, of course, we went from Hanoi to Clark Air Base in the Philippines. And that was the first feeling of, I'm safe. The second one was actually, like you stated, it was at Travis Air Force Base for me in California. And it was the same thing. Not only was it safe, I was now in a uniform. When we came out of Hanoi, we were in the clothes they gave us, but now I'm in a uniform and I'm on American soil and there's my family. And it's like, it was elation beyond elation. And I'm not a normally over emotional person. At least I don't show it like some people do, but it was just, and I hadn't seen my son. My son was born while I was missing in action. I was MIA for most of, 6 months of my 9 months. I was, so my son was born, oddly enough, when I left to go to Vietnam, my wife was pregnant. And we'd picked out a name, if it was a boy and it was a girl, it was me this. Well, he was a boy and I was MIA, so she named him after me, not the name that we chose, and I don't recall what it was. But anyway, I hadn't seen him. He was 5 months old when I came home. So it was quite emotional and quite, at the same time, it was almost like a dream, like this can't be real. You know, I've been taking one day at a time and not accepting a lot of emotional things, but here I am, all of a sudden it's emotional. And you know, because we were reserved over there. We showed no emotion when they read us the peace agreement. We showed no emotion when we went out and got on the 141 until we were in international airspace. We were all just, I don't want to say pan-faced, but that's a good term. We just had no emotion. So it's like flipping the switch. All of a sudden, now I can be emotional.
I can't even comprehend like what you just said and how difficult that must have been. When you finally got to the Philippines, is that when you were able to speak to your wife for the first time?
Yes, they gave us the times of difference and all that, but we all had an opportunity to call family and talk about things. I was gone 9 months as a POW, and we talked a few times before I was shot down. We had phone calls you could make from Vietnam, but they were very short and they weren't, you know, they weren't in depth.
And the delay, I imagine, was
all
crazy.
That stuff. Yeah, it was, I don't want to say it was awkward, but it was kind of, you're talking to a stranger almost. She'd been through a whole bunch of her own pregnancy without me there and not knowing where I was, dead or alive, and then just the whole bit. So she had her own shock, if you will, in that sense. So it was somewhat like two strangers talking to each other, getting reacquainted. And like I said, I was only gone a little more than that, because I was gone from, a year and a half roughly, but in round numbers. But I can only imagine some of the guys that were there for so many years. I mean, to try to catch up. I mean, I didn't get any letters. That was one of the things that, because of my harassing them, I refused to write letters because they wanted me to write certain things I do refuse to. So I didn't write letters. So consequently, they didn't give me letters. after I was towards the end, I started writing letters because they did give me a couple of letters. Oddly enough, when my son was born in October, that's when they released my name. And I got all these letters that had been written from the time I was shot down. So I didn't, you know, you can't, those letters that they let you have wasn't really communication in a sense. About all it did was, it was it give you confidence that, the, you know, that person's still alive and they love you or are interested in you, but they weren't long. Five lines doesn't give you a lot of space to get into any details. Plus, what are you going to talk about other right. than say, or I'm doing fine, or I can't wait to see you, those kind of very trite expressions. But
and you mentioned how you were kind of had to be pan-faced, that you weren't allowed to show emotion. When you came back and you went back into normal military life, doing your job as an Air Force officer, but also being back at home, how long did it take you to restore your natural personality or your natural emotions that you had?
Oh, I didn't feel like it took that long, but I'll tell you what took a little bit of time was to get over the response of the American people and many organizations that were doing so many things for us. I don't know what it was like for you when you came back from Iraq, but you know, the guys that were coming, the service members coming back in Vietnam did not get a real good welcome home. Mm-hmm. We got all this welcome home stuff that was, to me, it was almost embarrassing. I felt really unworthy of it for a couple of reasons. One, that I didn't lose that many friends in Vietnam, but a couple high school buddies are on the wall. Their names are on the wall. And squadron mates from the squadron I was in. But a majority, we got all this heroism heaped upon us. And, you know, I'm in there with guys like Eb Alvarez and, you know, those guys that were there so long. And I felt, you know, why me? I didn't really do anything other than endure 9 months of a relatively easy time compared to these other guys. So, and it was hard to get emotional about it because I felt that I didn't deserve it.
And there's always that comparison, right? Like, I think that's the plight of the warfighter is when someone tells you thanks for your service or how difficult was that, we all naturally go to, oh, well, it was worse for this person. It was worse for this person. And we almost let comparison be the thief of our joy and the thief of our accomplishments for what we've had. And it's interesting to hear, because Charlie Plum, he's been on the show, and I believe he was a prisoner of war for 5.5 years. And he mentioned people that were there longer than him. And I, the way that I am having this podcast, if I was there for 3 days, I'd be like, I was a prisoner of war for 3 days. And you guys in your generation, I mean, 275 days, that's about the length of the normal Marine deployment during the time that I was there is 275, 290 days. So for entire deployments, and those felt forever for us, we talked about forever. You had 135 missions and then the 275 days. And I imagine it wasn't you get out of Hanoi and then the next day you're back at home with your family. I imagine that was a process as well. You got to, at some point, Tom, you got to take that heroism on the chin and know that people like me and people who are listening to this show appreciate what you went through and the type of demeanor that you and the people that were there with you, the other prisoners of war, have exuded over the last few years. And you're doing that with your organization now. Can you tell us what nonprofit, the Veteran Service Organization that you're a part of, and what it means to you and what it means to the community of other people who have service that are similar to yours?
Sure. When we came home in 73, we started an organization called NOMPALS Incorporated, which is a fraternal military 501(c)(3), I think it's 19. Military fraternal organization. And we've gotten together with reunions every, it used to be every 2 years or thereabouts. In the last couple of years, we've had them every year for a variety of reasons, but we primarily to have reunions and gather. I've been blessed to be one of the first late shoot downs to be the president of that organization, 2010 to 2014 was my stint. And I'm currently their director of communication, which means I put out the newsletters and other kind of things and keep the website up. But it's quite an honor to be with these guys. I've gotten to know so many of them because of that, those positions that I've been in. And they're just I'll tell you, the best group of people, every one of them. The integrity that these guys have is just beyond belief. And you mentioned it about just accept what you did is honorable and that you deserve it. And that's every one of them is similar, says, look, if you were there one day, and oh, by the way, your efforts in 72 and your fellow aviators got us home. You helped bring us home. So we should be, we're thankful for you, for the time you spent, getting us home. So, but still, 75%, roughly 75% of the guys shot down over North Vietnam and held in North Vietnam were there between 1964 and 68. 1968 was a bombing halt. Then back in 72, when the North Vietnamese came across, we went north again. So 25% of us were shot down in 72 of that 691 people that came out. So yes, there was a fair number of us, and I do accept it. I still, the guys who are my heroes are the ones that did not come home. That they gave the ultimate sacrifice. And you lost people over there. I know that I've read about what the Marines went through in Fallujah, and I just shake my head. I've seen some of even the movies don't do it justice. You know that doesn't, it's hard to film combat.
Yeah.
And get the emotion in it. But I've seen some stuff, and I've seen the movies of and combat footage of Vietnam, the guys slogging through I just shake my head how they could do that every day. You know, when I flew, we went back to a base that had air conditioning and we had a club. We could go have a beer, et cetera, and unwind a little bit.
But Tom, we're not going to listen to how good things were for you.
Yeah, I know.
We're just not going to do it.
First thing the Air Force does is put a runway in. The second thing they put in a golf course. No, but seriously, the ground forces, that's what we're there to support. And I tell you, my hat's off to anyone who serves either the Marines or the Army on the ground. It's just awesome. I shake my head every day.
Well, I always say about Fallujah that the biggest source of honor for me is not just being from the Battle of Fallujah, but in the Marine Corps birthday message, we're listed alongside of operation like Ho Chi Minh City, that we are in the same breath. It's Ho Chi Minh City, Fallujah, and Marja. And being in that message with people that are represented by people like you is an honor, and it will always be an honor to me. And every time I hear it, I can't believe that we're associated with warriors like yourself and the people that you are there with. It's one of the greatest honors of my life, truly.
Well, I tell you, I seriously appreciate it myself. Like I say, anyone who serves, and I get those same thanks you're talking about. And, from civilians, and I say to them, you're serving our country some way. Everybody does, or it's a country. I said, you for example, you're working and paying taxes, and you helped pay my salary. Mm-hmm. I said, without you doing that, I wouldn't be out there working either. So I try to not, I do accept it, trust me, I do, but I also want them to know that we need their help too, we really do.
Last question I have for you, Tom. What was that back pay check like?
Well, actually, the paycheck, I had a spouse, so she was,
okay.
So she got the money, but you're going to laugh at this one, and I don't remember the number, but we got some kind of TDY pay. You're going to say, you got to be kidding me. TDY pay to Hanoi? Yes. TDY pay, it was like.
Typical Air Force.
I want to say it was for all of us, actually. It was $5 a day, I think. It may have been less than that, but some of the guys got a nice chunk of change. They were there for And some of the guys were bachelors. There's a couple of guys in my group that were bachelors, so they had all their pay, plus they had their, it was a hell of a forced savings plan, you know, not being able to go out to spend any money. But yeah, the only quote back pay I got was that $5 a day TDY pay that DOD, and I don't understand how they ever came up with that. I guess.
$5 a day is ridiculous. I'd rather have nothing than $5. At least, yeah. $5, you recognize that you did something. Zero, like, I'd rather have zero than $5.
Yes, you're right.
Well, Tom, we appreciate your time today. And again, we appreciate your service. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. And same to you and the rest of the folks that listen to your podcast. I appreciate your interest, to be honest with you. It's great. Thank you again.
Thank you, Tom.
Yes.